We are glad to make all of our JCast Network podcasts free for our listeners. However, they are not free to produce and host. Please consider making a donation to JCast Network to help support our work by visiting jcastnetwork.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we will be interviewing David Fishman. He is a professor of history and has come out recently with a book, The Book Smugglers, Partisans, Poets, and the Race to Save Jewish Treasures from the Nazis, the True Story of the Paper Brigade of Vilna. This is actually a very exciting book. We're going to talk to him, the ins and outs, the who, what, where, whens, and whys, and how. In the second half of the hour, we'll be discussing a little bit about the portion of the week, which is Va'era, which can be found in Exodus 6 and following. We've got a wonderful assortment of music today. One request came in. Yeah, we do requests. If you have a request for something you'd like to hear, drop me a line at rabbifinman.com. We'll try to find it for you and play it. You betcha. An absolutely awesome Hasidic story at the end concerning the passing of the first Lubavitch Rebbe, whose yahrzeit is observed this Friday. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Israeli lawmakers approved a bill that would make it harder to cede parts of Jerusalem in a future peace deal. 80 votes would be needed to give any part of Jerusalem to the Palestinians instead of 61, which is what it is currently now. So now they need 80. Hamas continued to fire rockets from Gaza into southern Israel. 5 rockets were shot this week. Israeli tanks destroyed several Hamas positions in Gaza. Palestinian teen believed to be carrying a gun was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers in a riot in the West Bank. The teen was among 30 Palestinian throwing rocks at Israeli troops. Soldiers opened fire after they saw the teen holding what appeared to be a gun. Israel said it uncovered an Iranian spy ring in the West Bank that was planning to carry out terror attacks and was collecting intelligence for Iran. The Israeli security agency, known as the Shin Bet, said that the group was recruited and financed by an Iranian operative in South Africa. For current, in other news around the world, 4 current and former flight attendants filed suit against Delta Airlines, alleging that the airline's management has an anti-Jewish attitude. Don't you say I said anti-Jewish, not anti-Semitic, but anti-Jewish attitude. The lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court in Westchester, New York. All the plaintiffs worked on the airline's New York to Tel Aviv route. 27-year-old clay stamp from the First Temple period inscribed in ancient Hebrew was unearthed in the Western Wall Plaza in Jerusalem. It's one of the things the Arabs are so up in arms, you know, you're digging around our mosque. In the meantime, we're finding things that are predate Islam by about 2,000 years. The stamp mentions the name of a Judean governor mentioned in the Book of Kings. Another proof that, yeah, we were there. Bible's true, 100%. And finally, the population of Israel is 8,793,000, 75% of which are Jews. 180,000 babies were born in Israel, and 27,000 new immigrants arrived in Israel over the course of the year 2017. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Fenman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online Professor David Fishman, who's a professor of history at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. Just came out with a book, The Book Smugglers, Partisans, Poets, and the Race to Save Jewish Treasures from the Nazis, The True Story of Paper Brigade of Vilna. How are you, David?
Fine. Thank you, Rabbi Fishman. Looking forward to our conversation.
Oh, the pleasure will be all mine. I know for sure, just even by looking at the book. Okay, so there have been various treatises and even movies about the Nazis plundering. We had them plundering art, we have them plundering music, plundering valuables. Here it is now, we have another twist on things, that yes, they were even plundering books. Now, we do know that books can be worth something. We had, 2 weeks ago, we had a lady on from Sotheby's who was talking about a book from the 1420s, which went for auction, which is now part of the Metropolitan Museum of Art's collection. So we know there are valuable books, but what's the deal over here with this and what the Nazis were trying to do in Vilna, David Fishman?
Well, the story is even more surprising than that, because the Nazis were plundering Jewish books written in Yiddish and in Hebrew and in other languages. But the Nazis had a special interest in plundering Judaica because they had created a whole field of anti-Semitic Jewish studies of their own called Judenforschung. And this so-called science of the study of the Jews would legitimize and would justify, you know, their persecution of the Jews and eventually their, you know, genocide against the Jews. So it was science in the service of Nazism. But if they wanted to have such a field, they knew they needed Jewish books. And they also knew that Vilna had great Jewish collections. And that's how this story gets started. They wanted to plunder the best stuff for their anti-Semitic scholars.
Let me just jump in over here. So, but there were other major centers, Warsaw, Kovno, Lublin, that were also major centers. Were there other such depositories and set up through the Nazi conquered territories, David?
Yes, the Nazis did this kind of work really just about all across Europe, not even Eastern Europe, but they stole Jewish libraries from Amsterdam and from Paris, and even in Greece from Salonika. But when it came to Eastern Europe, they knew that because they'd actually studied this before invading Eastern Europe, that the greatest Jewish library collections were in Vilna. The YIVO, the Yiddish Scientific Institute, the Strashum Library, the Jewish Community Library. The city had a very strong tradition of learning, of printing, of collecting, and the Nazis knew it.
Mm-hmm. It was after Vilna was called the Jerusalem of Lithuania, was it not?
That's right.
Okay, so tell us, how is it that the Nazis began perpetrating this crime against humanity?
Well, the paradox is they knew they wanted these books, but they didn't have enough staff, the Nazis, to send, you know, people fluent in Hebrew and in Yiddish, Nazis fluent in Hebrew and Yiddish, to Vilna, let alone to all these other places, to Amsterdam, to Paris, to Salonika. So in Vilna, they had to hire Jews as slave laborers to sort the material, and that is to decide what should be sent to Germany because it was important and valuable, and what to destroy, because that's what the Nazis came up with. Basically a quota of 30% can be sent to Germany and 70% will be destroyed. And they hired, I keep using that term, but it's really not the right term. They took a group of Jewish intellectuals, though it was full of intellectuals, that is, educators, scholars, writers, artists, librarians, and they forced them to do this. This very difficult job of selecting, you know, what should be sent to Germany and what should be destroyed. And, of course, these are all book lovers, these Jewish slave laborers, and it pains them, the sight of seeing mountains of Jewish books being sent to their destruction. And, of course, they come up with a plan that they must save as much as they can. They must hide as much as they can from the Nazis.
Okay, so let's talk about the 30%. There's a lot, like you said, there's a lot of books in Vilna at this time. So 30% of the books which they considered to be worthwhile in keeping was a massive amount of material that probably filled up many train car loads. What happened with all that, with all those materials?
That material was sent to Germany. Most of it ended up in Frankfurt, where there was an institute for the investigation of the Jewish question. Luckily, at the end of the war, Frankfurt was in the American zone of occupied Germany. The American military discovered the books at the Institute for the Investigation of the Jewish Question. And the books that were from Vilna were sent to the YIVO Institute, which had relocated during the war from Vilna to New York. And the YIVO New York was recognized as the heir of YIVO Vilna, and more generally the heir to Jewish libraries from Vilna. This was a refugee institution from Vilna. So that ended up actually, paradoxically, having a happy ending. Those 30% after the war were found and sent to the United States.
Is much of that stuff in the Jewish Theological Library then now?
Excuse me?
Is much of that material now in the JTS library? I know that to such an extent.
There are similar materials, not the Vilna materials, but there are similar Nazi-looted books that ended up in Germany that are in all major Judaica libraries in the world, including JTS, including the Hebrew University. The Vilna material went to YIVO, but other looted Jewish books where the ownership could not be determined, because what they found in Germany were 1.5 million Jewish books. 1.5 million Jewish books.
That's a lot of stuff.
Representing the culture and civilization of European Jewry. And many of them you could not identify who the owners had been before the war, and even if you could, the organization was defunct. You weren't going to return it to the city where there were no Jews, and that material was distributed to major Jewish libraries like the Hebrew University, like the Jewish Theological Seminary, and many others, also by the Americans.
Okay, so which is that's fascinating in and of itself, that story. Okay, so let's go back. So now we have 40 individuals who are now trying to save. So if let's say we have 1.5 million books is the 30%, if I can do my math correctly, which at this time in the morning
I have to
can't.
Correct you, because 1.5 million is from all of Europe.
Uh-huh, okay.
But in Vilna, we are talking about...
You're still talking about 4 or 5 million books.
100,000, maybe 150,000 books.
That went to Germany. So that's going to mean that there's somewhere around 800,000 or so volumes that are earmarked in Vilna to be destroyed.
Right.
So That's a lot of paper to move. And so what was the plan?
Actually, the plan was either just incineration, and there were incineration sites, you know, furnaces, and some of it was sent for recycling. There were, since paper was in demand and not an easy supply during the war, you could, you know, basically melt the paper down into a pulp and then create new paper out of it. And again, it was Jewish laborers, there were technical workers, who did all the lugging, you know, packing in boxes, loading it up, so that it was sent to these either incinerators or recycling centers.
Okay, so did these, or if you're just joining us, our guest today is Professor David Fishman, who has written a book called The Book Smugglers, about the Nazis trying to steal every Jewish thing that was worth anything in Europe. In this case, we're talking about books. So now, did you discover in your research a criteria as to what these 40 people deemed worth smuggling? Because there's a lot of things that got printed, which, if they were made remade into pulp paper, I personally probably would not have objected and would probably say, oh, that it's a pity on the trees that were cut down to print that. But so what was the criteria? What were they looking for? Because the really good stuff, that's already sent out of town. So now we're talking about tier two stuff.
Well, often they could prevent the really good stuff from actually even getting to Germany. Because they're doing the sorting themselves, you know, what should be sent to Germany, what should be sent to destruction. So it's at that moment where they can even, you know, hide something. As you just said, the Germans were not present every minute. And they were not in every room. So there were opportunities for them to hide stuff at the work site. As for the criteria, you know, the top criteria is opportunity. In other words, the right moment to hide something. They had a very broad vision. In other words, they saved both religious literature and secular Yiddish and Hebrew literature. Obviously, they tried to save one copy of books. In other words, sometimes 10 or 15 copies of the same book would pass through their hands. There's no need to save 15 copies. So that was the basic criteria, one copy of an item. I should add, they not only saved books, but there were a lot of documents, manuscripts, archives, so a lot of even Torah scrolls. So it's a very diverse amount of kind of material. And I should add, they rescued even non-Jewish material, because the Germans started using this worksite to process not only Jewish books, but also Russian and Polish books, because they realized they have a very capable, intelligent, skilled slave labor force. So a lot of non-Jewish material passed through the group's hands, and they rescued that as well. So I would, to answer your question, say they had a very broad vision of what to save.
Amazing. I'm actually fascinated by all this, David Fishman. So now the Nazis, Maximum, were very systematic. They had controls over everything. People basically couldn't breathe unless they were told you could breathe. As you write in the book, that if they were caught going back into the Vilna ghetto with a potato, they were shot on the spot with no questions asked. So you're talking books, Torah scrolls. These are things that take up a lot of space. You can't just kind of like say stick one in your pocket. So how did they smuggle this stuff out?
First of all, you're right. The main way they smuggled was by taking stuff into the ghetto. The worksite was outside of the ghetto, and they had to get it through the gate into the ghetto. Smaller stuff you could put on your body. Not only in a pocket, but literally under your pants, around your waist, even little things, you know, in your boots and your shoes. They were loaded up under the clothing. And everything depended on who would guard the gate. If there weren't Germans there, the inspection at the gate would be relatively light. They had other ways to rescue material other than literally on their bodies. They did give materials to non-Jewish friends. Non-Jewish friends could visit them during the lunch hour. The Germans went away for the lunch hour, and you'd have they had non-Jewish friends who would come. They'd give things to non-Jews who held it. And finally, on rare occasions, and this took special efforts, you could even get, with help from others in the ghetto, you could get a vehicle, a truck, that was, for instance, going to enter the ghetto to remove snow or enter the ghetto to bring in official food rations. You could steal the larger items either inside or underneath the truck. So they had a lot of devices on how to smuggle in material.
Okay, so now they have this material. It is no longer in Nazi hands. Pretty much at this time, people realized that the existence of the Vilna ghetto is not going to be permanent. And so there's no point in like hiding the stuff under their beds. So what were they doing with these materials that they
Never hiding it under their bed. The biggest thing they're doing is they have a bunker. They have several underground bunkers. Some of them, one of them especially, very deep underground, 100 feet underground, with electricity, with ventilation. And it was actually used by the ghetto resistance, the underground fighters, who were planning to have an uprising. The fighters, stored arms there, and this group stored books there side by side.
Amazing. Hoping that someday they would be recovered. So if you're just joining us, our guest today is Professor David Fishman, is a historian, wrote a book called The Book Smugglers, Partisans, Poets, and the Race to Save Jewish Treasures from the Nazis, a true story. What reads this book, which is which goes in the nonfiction section, reads like any good spy book. It's just really very compelling writing, I must say, about this.
I do have to keep reminding people this is nonfiction.
They
think, what a great novel.
Yes.
No, this is not a novel. This is history.
Very compelling. It was like one of these things, how does it end? It's like I kept on wanting to say, well, let me just read the last chapter. No, I'm not going to do that. It was a wonderfully, wonderfully read. This is not an academic work of literary prose. No, this is a great book. The Lithuanian Jewry is decimated. The number of people that are alive today who can say that 100 years ago my grandfather lived in Lithuania is very small. So the Vilna, as a major center of Judaism now, are there 1,000 Jews living in Vilna, 2,000 Jews that live in Vilna? There's not a whole lot of Judaism, per se, in Vilna. What happened with all of this material that they hid? Is it still in hiding? Is there some way that they can, you can't hide, I have to hide where I hid it, so.
Some of the members of this work brigade, slave laborers, some of them survived. Most did not survive. But a few did, especially these two Yiddish poets, Abraham Sutzgewera and Schmerke Kaczerginski. And they return. They come back, the survivors in this group, and they come back only to find the books, not to find whatever, relatives, or property. They know everybody's gone, and they don't care about having an apartment back. They go to dig up the books, and they develop a whole operation of volunteers, some with shovels and some with their bare hands, retrieving. And they retrieve an enormous amount of material. They create a Jewish museum in Vilna. This is all happening in the summer of 1944. The war is still waging, but Vilna has been liberated. And so the material was in this Jewish museum. But these poets quickly realize that Vilna is now part of the Soviet Union. And literally within months, the Soviet bureaucracy starts to strangle the museum.
So we're talking about out of the frying pan into the fire over here.
Exactly. It's something they never imagined. First of all, the KGB gives them orders. You're not allowed to show the books to anybody. This must go through censorship. Some of the books that were in the courtyard of this museum, there was no space for them in the building, so they're out in the courtyard, were taken away and sent to their destruction by the Soviets, right? So, and that's when these poets realize the books are in danger again. We have to rescue whatever we can. And that's the second rescue is to smuggle the books out of the Soviet Union across the border to Poland. And so the end story is some of this material was smuggled out in suitcases and many suitcases and eventually reached both the United States and Israel. Much of the material remained in Soviet Vilna, and eventually the Soviets closed that museum, and that material was not available to anybody for the next 40 years, from 1949 to 1989. Basically, nobody knew about the fate of those books seized by the Soviets.
Okay, so then what happened in 1989, then, David?
Oh, 1980. Well, the late 1980s. You know, there's
Glasnost and Perestroika. Yes,
right. Glasnost, Perestroika, and a lot more openness. And word reached YIVO, New York, that their books, their library, their archive, parts of it, are still in Vilnius, as it's called in Lithuania, in Vilnius, Lithuania. And YIVO began efforts to retrieve its collections. Now, those books are still in Lithuania, but there's an agreement between YIVO and the Lithuanians to digitize everything, to put it online.
It's sort of like the same, sorry to talk over you, but it's sort of like the same thing that's going on with like the Schneerson Library and the YIVO Library is the Russians have it. They're not giving it up. It's now a Russian treasure, as they call it, but we'll let you look at it.
Right. This is quite similar, though, one step better, because not only are you able to look at it, but literally every single page will be available on the internet. And that's actually good in certain ways, because there are manuscripts and documents where some of the pages are in New York at YIVO, and some of the pages are in Lithuania. Right? Can you imagine that? A single document, some of it stayed behind and some of it was smuggled out or was sent out. So with this digitization, you'll be able to reintegrate, you know, to have the full manuscript, both the parts from New York and Lithuania. But bottom line, you're right. The Lithuanians don't want to give it up. And this was a compromise that was reached.
Okay. And so is YIVO happy with this compromise? I mean, there's other people, other organizations that have books, and there's not all 100% YIVO stuff.
That's right. There's other books of all kinds. I personally, let me speak on my own behalf because I don't represent YIVO here, less than happy with this. Less than happy. I understand that for scholars, you know, a digital copy is as good as the original, maybe even better, the quality of what, and the ability to zoom in. For scholars, it's the same, maybe even better. But this is not only a scholarly thing. We have to remember, people risk their lives to rescue these books. And they didn't risk their lives so that the Jewish world would have a digital copy. They risked their lives so that this material would be returned, restored to the Jewish people. So, you know, I wish the ending was even better, but the ending isn't a bad ending. At least this material has survived, thanks to the heroism of these people, and at least now it will be available and accessible.
Are there still findings, like troves, around the city of Vilna?
Yes. A trove was found in the Lithuanian National Library literally last year, this last summer. I went to Vilnius. This is after I finished my book. My book was already in press. And I get an email from YIVO that they just found more material. Would I go to Vilnius to look it over? And it's an enormous trove. Not books, but all of it, historical documents and manuscripts. And I'm sure there's more somewhere, either underground or who knows where.
Okay. So, of course, with the way the Americans work, in any of the stuff that you've seen or that which has been cataloged, is there anything like really eye-popping, like things that this might be the only existant copy of?
Oh, many such things. For me, the most touching thing was this poet who was in the slave labor brigade, Sutzkever. Many consider him the greatest Yiddish poet of the 20th century. He wrote poetry in the Vilna ghetto. And he later published those poems basically based on memory. He remembered his poems that he wrote in the ghetto. And they become quite famous in the work, and they're fantastic poems. In this latest trove, we found the original manuscripts of his ghetto poems written in 1942, in 1943. We never had that before. And it's a single manuscript. And it's, of course, a testimony, as is this whole story, to Jewish spiritual resistance in the Holocaust. Writing poetry and exquisite poetry in the ghetto, what kind of resources, energy, and faith do you have to do that?
Okay, let's make a proposition. We're going to end off with this because the time is running out. This is very fascinating. I could spend the whole hour on this. But let's say that the Book Smugglers is made into a movie. And as movie companies and producers are wont to do, is they want to make sequels. So we leave off at the end of the movie with just like this like question, this paradox, this conundrum. Is there anything like that now with the Book Smugglers, David Fishman?
Now you're asking me to do what I didn't want to do, which is, you know, I wrote the history. Now you're asking me to
predict the future.
Imagine how I would make a sequel from the history. I'm not sure I can do that. For me, if there's partially an unresolved question, but it is to me, why the Germans who did this looting and destruction were never brought to justice. And I follow that in the book, and none of them, you know, this is a crime. This is a crime, destroying the people's culture, just as it's happening now in Iraq and in Afghanistan. When you destroy temples, and the books are Jewish temples, you know, none of them were punished. So that's, for me, the conundrum, why the Allies didn't pursue them.
Okay. Are any of them still alive?
No. I followed all
point.
Of them.
They
were adults, of course, the Germans sent there, so they're not alive anymore. It's too late to punish them.
Right. Understood. Okay, we're going to leave it at that. Again, our guest has been David Fishman. He's a professor of history at the Jewish Theological Seminary, written a book called The Book Smugglers, Partisans, Poets, and the Race to Save Jewish Treasures from the Nazis, The True Story of the Paper Brigades of Vilna. It is quite a fine book. It is not a novel, but it reads better than one. I'm waiting. Are you in discussion with, say, Spielberg to turn this into a movie, and how soon will that be, Dave?
Not at the moment, but, you know, I'll wait.
Waiting for the phone to ring. Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been fascinating and really wonderful.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurances accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Let's get right to some music. This is a song which was originally produced 10 years ago. It's a song, it's called Unity, and it is composed by Mordechai Ben-David, sung by a cast of probably, I guess, 100 musicians at the time. And it was to show our solidarity with Shalom Rubashkin, who was at that time being pursued by the federal government for crimes against humanity, you should pardon the expression, for all kinds of horrible things that he was done. He was actually thrown in jail for 27 years and was released just about 3 weeks ago. And so they came out with the updated Unity version of Unity. And so that's what we're playing right now.
Like angels in the sky, in a garden full of glory, the galaxy so brilliantly related. Ultimately high on the first page of our story, till the time parents were created. Envious brother Cain threw a blow so mad and chilling, tragically we never did recover.
Ooh, it's really so insane, all our selfishness that's killing.
It's strange, who's our sister and our brother. So listen, brother, listen, friend, just a little smile, a helping hand, and we all will find a loving, kind humanity. We must teach our children to treat your fellow friends. Could you lift him up with you now and fly him home with justice, pride, and freedom?
His eyes are gazing wide from behind the bars. He prays now with faith, with joy.
Oh, how we wait to greet him. Ages rushing by, writing chapters for love, sorrow.
Webs of self-destruction we are weaving.
If we don't even try, there's no hope for our tomorrow.
So what's it all worth if we are not achieving?
So listen, brother.
Just
Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Hey, Schultzman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. As we said at the beginning of the program, we did have a request. The person is anonymous. Said, pointed out to me that this next week will be the 10th anniversary of the passing of Moshe Yes, of the famous Megama group. And we haven't played a whole lot of Moshe Yes in the course of this show because Megama broke up. I don't know, they were popular in the 70s, and Moshe Yes went out on his own afterwards. It was the early 80s, and we didn't start the show until the 90s. So they were really weren't around, so we haven't played a whole lot. But they requested, could we play his signature piece, which is Zadie, which means my grandfather.
Home. He used to laugh, he put me on his knee, and he spoke about his life in Poland. He spoke, but with a bitter memory, and he spoke about the soldiers who would beat him. They laughed at him, they tore his long black coat. And he spoke about a synagogue that they burnt down, and the crying that was heard beneath the smoke. But Zadie made us laugh, Zadie made us sing, and Zadie made a kiddish Friday night. And Zadie, oh my Zadie, how I love him so. And Zadie used to teach me wrong from right. And many winters went by, and many summers came along. And now my children sit in front of me. And who will be the Zadie of my children? Who will be their Zadie if not me? And who will be the Zadie of my children? Who will be their Zadie if not me?
Zadie, in memory of Moshe Yes. Speaking of Yes, Yes, this is the portion of Va'era can be found in Exodus chapter 6. The opening is really one of my favorite interchanges between Moses and God. And it really shows an indication of how we should be leading our lives. What's the deal? We left off last week. Moses was told by God, go to tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And God said that he's going to say no. So Moses comes to Pharaoh and says, God says, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, no,
And not only am I not letting him go, I'm making their lives more miserable. So now Moses comes out and everybody hates him. So Moses goes back to God and says, I told you it wasn't going to work. I quit. God says, what's your problem? Says, this is not called for. He says, look at Abraham. Abraham got thrown into a furnace and walked out. Did he quit? No. Isaac got bound for slaughter. Did he quit? No. Jacob, if you look at him, you see what a miserable life he led. From the time, like, in the womb already, fighting with his brother, and then the whole battle with the birthright, and stealing the blessings, and then having to live with Laban, and then coming back with the brother, and then the Joseph getting stolen over there. So, I mean, did Jacob quit? No. I says, and look what they got out of the deal. What did they get out of it? What did they get for all their working? They got, it says in this week's portion, they got to talk to me with Kael Shakai, which are two names of God, which happen to be two lower revelations of God. God says to Moses, the burning bush, the first thing you do is ask me, what's my name? Like, it makes a difference. What's my name? And what name does God show him? He shows him the highest name of God. You get it full jets. And the first thing that happens is you say, I quit. And I said at the onset that I didn't want him to say, okay, go ahead. Because what kind of story is it going to be? What would the book of Exodus look like if Moses went to Pharaoh and said, God said, let the Jews go. And Pharaoh said, okay. And that was that. What kind of book is that? So he said, no, I promised Abraham that there's going to be like a big ta-da-dum over here, 10 plagues. They're going to go out with pomp and circumstance. This is going to be a whole big deal. So where's this going with us? This is not, we don't do the trivia thing. That's not us. Even though at Jewish Ferndale, we will be doing a Jewish trivia night. We're having a non-Super Bowl party on the night of the Super Bowl, which I think is February 4th, if I'm not mistaken, at 7 o'clock. And you don't have to have any great knowledge. We have great prizes and whatnot. But Judaism's not trivia. You know, and of course, there'll be snacks and games, but there won't be a Super Bowl. It's for all those people who really don't care about the Super Bowl. Judaism's not into trivia. Judaism's not into it. We are historical. I mean, it says that we have very great care of our history when we preserve our history and we learn from our history. That's the main thing. So here it is. We are confronted daily. Okay, look at the weather. I mean, who wants to go outside when the real feel, forget about the number. We really don't need to worry about what the number is. Okay, when you walk outside and it says, the man is telling you, the real feel, it feels like 25 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, which any way you spell that is cold. It really is. And I don't want to do that. I don't want to get out of bed. I just want to stay here and stay warm and toasty and drink cocoa and whatever it is. No. Almighty says, listen, there's going to be challenges in your life. But the really good thing is that when you get over the challenge, you're now a stronger, better, accomplished individual. And just sitting back and drinking cocoa is not going to do it. You know, we all like to do that. I'd like to have like a Sunday. This is my ideal Sunday. Is like I kind of sleep in a little late. I'm sitting there in my bathrobe. I got a copy of the New York Times, a cup of coffee, maybe a stack of pancakes that my wife made me. Do you know how many times I've done that? I'm married 35 years. Not once, because Sunday's my busiest day between the radio show and teaching and running around and koshering factories, getting these factories that are ready for the week to be up and running. I am running from, without an exaggeration, 5:30 in the morning until midnight on Sunday. It's my busiest day. So there's no pancakes for me, but I would like. So we can't always have what we would like, but we always get what's best for us. And the Almighty really knows what really is the best thing for the world. We're going with the flow. We really don't even have to jump so high. Okay, our lives are not like running over hurdles. It's more kind of like hanging onto a surfboard that we know how to surf. I've never been on a surfboard, but I can imagine you really don't have to like jump a whole lot. You just got to kind of like go with the flow. Okay, it goes up, it goes down. It looks a little, maybe a little hairy, a little scary. Like that. It's all good. The shore is right in front of you. That's one of those rules I teach in surfing, is just keep the shore in front of you and you'll get there. And that's really what the Almighty wants of us, just one day at a time. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard. The Specs Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Hey, Rabbi Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? RabbiFinman.com. You'll be able to, right on the homepage, you'll be able to contact me. I went to a book publisher the beginning of the week to request a book. There was no way to contact these people. It's like, how am I supposed to know what? It just didn't exist. You know, so I had to call up the phone number that they had over there, and I had to ask them, who's your person, and can I have a number? Can I have an email? It was really a big hassle. But Rabbi Finman, no hassles. Right there, you'll be able to contact me. You'll also have archived editions of the radio show, the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, Hasidic U-Story, all there for you to enjoy. There's also the donations page. I must commend, I am duly humbled that after my appeal last week, when I said that we only had 2 months left, and now, then I said, but it'll be 3 months next week, and I stopped and said, but that's next week. We're still in December. Right now, in December, we're 2 months behind. We had November and December, but it's December 31st. Tomorrow will be 3 months. Okay? I'm very happy and humbled to report that the Jewish Hour is only 2 months. November was paid for this week. I was amazed at people's generosity, people getting their donations in on RabbiFinman.com and sending the money to Jewish Ferndale at the Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Really very much appreciated. And for those who haven't, I can't ask those people who really stepped up to the plate last week, but I know there are people out there, and you may be one of them, that didn't step up last week. Okay, that's good. Listen, I got nothing to say. You have your reason, whatever it is. You didn't need the tax donation deduction. That's fine. It's a new week. You're listening. You want this show to continue. Go to RabbiFinman.com. Make that donation today. I want to spend a half a minute talking about what's happening up in Jewish Ferndale, 1725 Pinecrest Drive. Now you can know it because we have this 13-foot menorah on the lawn, and you can see it from 4 blocks away. We've got some things coming up. First of all, on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, we're having a mommy and me. You have to be a mommy, and you have to have a me, okay? Which means me is anybody under 4 years old. So if you're under 4 years old, you're Jewish, and you live within the sound of my voice and can make it to 1725 Pinecrest. So this is a group. They get together once a month. It's a very successful group. There's arts and crafts for the kids. There's crafting for the mommies. There's coffee clutching, of course, and snacks and treats. And it's just a real wonderful time. It's really very heartwarming to see this group, Mommy and Me. That's this coming Tuesday at 10:30 till noon. And please park in the Jewish Ferndale parking lot. We don't have that parking lot, so people can park around the corner, especially with this weather. It'll be warmer. It'll be 27 degrees. Wow. Then, of course, every Wednesday night now is yoga for women only. This is at 6:30 p.m., taught by Karen Small, who is a wonderful teacher. My wife tells it's kosher, so it doesn't matter what your religiosity is. Even if you're a very religious woman, you can partake of the benefits of yoga at Jewish Ferndale. Big things coming up. Well, we mentioned the Un-Super Bowl party in February, but at the end of the month, We're participating in the Ferndale Blues Festival. Put this on your calendar. That would be January 28th and February 1st at 8 o'clock. January 1st, we're featuring David Nefesh and Ethan Davidson. And February 1st, we're featuring a Jewish story corps where people will come and tell stories. If you had a story, we're still looking for one more person. Get in touch with me on rabbifinman.com, and my wife will go through your story. And it's backed by the Saul Anthony Ensemble, since it is blue. So if it's a little bit somber, we can have somebody playing do 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 do, boom, boom, as you're telling your story. It's going to be way cool. Okay, anyway, that's going to do it for the show. We want to thank you so much for tuning in. The Alter Rebbe's Yahrzeit, his passing, is this celebrated Thursday night, just to mention it, and in passing. And one of his main goal was that the divine presence be felt down here in whatever way, shape, or form a person happens to be able to do that. So make this week a good one. We'll see you back again next week. Take care. ותיק ימו רחמך, ימו רחמך, וחוסנה על בן אהובך. ותיק ימו רחמך, ימו רחמך.